Hello and welcome to episode number 71 of Chell Squared. I'm your host, Andrew Chelney, and as always, we've got a ton to get into today. Before we do, though, be sure to go back and listen to last week's episode, Pete Blackburn of CBS Sports. Stop by the show to talk Bruins, coaches on the hot seat, and a bunch more great stuff. Of course, before the show kicks off, the quick social media plug is in order. Please follow the podcast on Twitter at Chell Squared and on Facebook at Chell Squared for more hot takes, news about future guests, poll questions, and a whole lot more. If you want to follow my personal Twitter, it's at Chelney Andrew. One cool feature of the hosting platform of the podcast, Anchor.fm, is the supporter option. Chell Squared doesn't have any sponsors, though if you would like to sponsor the show, hit up my DMs, which are open, and we'll talk. I'm my own producer, host, editor, etc. I do the show out of love for the game on one of my days off from work. If you would like to become a supporter, all you have to do is hit support this podcast on anchor.fm and choose an amount you're comfortable with to support the show and also get exclusive content. Or if you'd like to support the show in other ways, you could always leave a rating, a review, or just share the podcast with others. Makes my day when I see hockey fans enjoying the weekly content, hot takes, and all. Chell Squared is a part of National Podcast Network, a network dedicated to NHL podcasts. Check the show out on there by going to nationalpodcast.network/Chell Squared. And though I am a SiriusXM employee, this podcast is not affiliated in any way with the company. The opinions expressed in this podcast are mine and mine alone and may or may not reflect the views of SiriusXM. If you're angry at my takes, direct them to me and me alone, please. And thank you. The Pittsburgh Penguins are good. The Pittsburgh Penguins are also bad. Both of these statements are true. Through 11 games so far this season, they're 6-5, and they've lost 3 straight. Matt Murray has been aggressively average so far. Jari's been very good in his 3 starts, but the team has only won a single game out of the 3, despite him rocking a .939 save percentage and a .301 goal saved above average in those starts. But let's not forget about the injuries. Malkin, Rust, Galchenyuk, Bjugstad, and Dumoulin are all out, forcing a lot of lineup shuffling. Hornqvist has appeared to rebound following a pretty bad showing last year with 5 goals and 8 points in 11 games so far. Sam Lafferty has seemingly emerged out of nowhere to score 5 points in his first 9 NHL games, but with those positives, Jack Johnson, Eric Branson, still on the team. Dominic Cahoon has just 2 assists in 11 games while playing on the second line. The Penguins have had to plug and play while they wait for their better star players to return. How good is this team right now, and how good can they realistically be if/when they return to full strength? And I'm not going to suggest Mike Sullivan's on the hot seat, but is Mike Sullivan on the hot seat? Also, Will the Penguins be buyers at the deadline? They've got a lot of decisions to make after this year. Both goaltenders will be RFAs, and Justin Schultz and Alex Galchenyuk are both on the last years of their deals, along with a bunch of other RFAs on the roster as well. Plus, a little bit later on in the show, Rangers prospect Vitali Kravtsov is leaving Hartford to go back to the KHL for the rest of the season, all while Brendan Smith plays on the third line. Nice job, guys. Phenomenal job. Plus, Mike Babcock said today the Leafs were well aware they couldn't keep Patty Marleau for the full 3 years, but signed him to that length anyway because they couldn't get Marleau to sign a 2-year deal. So they basically paid a first-round pick to Carolina in exchange for a 2-year rental, which is a plan. It's probably not a good plan, but it is, I guess, a plan. We'll get into all of that and a whole lot more. During the show is featured writer for Pittsburgh Hockey Now, Dan Kingerski. Dan, how are you? Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me, Andrew.
Absolutely. Appreciate you coming on. Before we get into the Penguins talk here, Dan, in your Twitter bio, you have once checked Wayne Gretzky in it. Tell me that story. How did that happen?
Oh, it's been a while since I've been asked about that. About a couple miles back, World Juniors, 12, 14 years ago, I was the Team USA play-by-play announcer. And as such, that was the year that Wayne Gretzky was the GM for Team Canada. Obviously, as you know, the World Juniors are over Christmas. You know, you're essentially there from December 24th to January 4th or 5th. I was in Grand Forks, North Dakota, for 2 blessed weeks, missing my family, upset, angry, etc. So one night, I was late. I had to get up to the press box. for the game. This lovely little volunteer, little old woman by the elevator said, "No, I'm sorry, sir. This elevator is being held for Mr. Gretzky." I said, "I'm sorry, I'm going up." So I hop on the elevator, I go up to the press box, and I go barging off, you know, miserable as all can be, head down, I storm off the elevator. Just as Wayne Gretzky and the entire Team Canada entourage is storming onto the elevator. Well, I'm a little bit bigger than Wayne Gretzky, pounds, a couple inches bigger than Wayne. He goes down. I realize that I've just knocked Wayne Gretzky to the ground. So as the Team Canada entourage, kind of picks Wayne Gretzky up or catches him from truly falling, I realize what I've done. I kind of blend into the crowd real quick and try not to be seen. I duck into a closet, like a little side press box room real quick, and hid before they realized what a jerk I'd been. And that's how I body checked Wayne Gretzky.
I don't think anybody could top that story, to be honest with you. I've had a number of people on the show, and that story has to be top five for, it's going to be top five, top three maybe even, for a long time. to be able to say, I body checked Wayne Gretzky, and not only did you do that, you did it off the ice. Like, it wasn't some alumni game, it wasn't some charity game. You made him fall to the floor as he was getting in the elevator. I mean, does he know about that? Does he know years after the fact that you were the person that did that to him?
Well, I sure as hell hope not, because otherwise I'd be waiting to see, like, Marty McSorley over my shoulder. I was mortified, yeah. That was, luckily, no one knew that it was me, and I kind of, years later, didn't admit it till a couple of years ago that actually that was me that almost, you know, killed the great one.
I'm sure you didn't harm him too bad. I would hope, right? I don't think, I would hope that he was okay after that vicious body check that you laid on him.
I don't know. Have you seen the lettuce? A couple hairs out of place could be devastating.
Well, one team that Gretzky did not play for, whether in his career or in the elevator, was for the Pittsburgh Penguins, who have dropped three straight. They started the year 6-2. Now they're 6-5. They've, like I said, lost three in a row. Their next game is tomorrow at Dallas, who they beat last week 4-2. But they got shut out against Vegas. They dropped their game against Florida, and then they also lost to the Lightning in a Wednesday night rivalry game, 3-2. Take me through these first couple of weeks for the Pittsburgh Penguins. They've dropped a lot of guys, like I said in the open. They've five big name guys are out of the lineup, a couple of them long term, and the last few games haven't gone their way right now. They're 6-5. Next game is tomorrow. Take me through the first couple of weeks of this season and what it's been like to watch the Pittsburgh Penguins as they kind of try to play through some of these injuries.
Yeah, it's been like watching an episode of MASH without the Groucho Marx impersonation, right? It's, you know, Malkin was really going to have a bounce back year. He had that spring in his step, that bit of fire in his eye. You know, he had the fire in the belly through training camp, which, generally speaking, veteran players can go half speed. No, Malkin was at full speed from day one. He and Hornquist both, and Galchenyuk too. Galchenyuk and Malkin really had this weird telepathy going, and it was fun to watch. However, all those injuries have gutted the team. You know, if Sidney Crosby doesn't provide the offense, they probably lose on any given night right now. They're going to get Brian Rust back, if not Jay. Then soon after, they'll get Nick Bjugstad back soon after as well, which will really help with the depth. I mean, watching the Penguins really is a couple different teams, because Jared McCann, while I really think he's made to be a winger, at center, he's very conservative. He's kind of in his head. His lines generally don't produce anything in the way of offense. right? So you've kind of got Sidney Crosby and Jake Gensel doing their thing on the top line. You had this great surprise with Sam Lafferty on the fourth line. They chipped in some offense, but this gaping black hole in the middle, plus, you know, the Penguins defense, which is much fan derided, kind of trying to find its footing with John Marino, too. So it's been interesting, to say the least.
You mentioned that MASH reference, and I'm going to be honest with you. I've never watched a single episode. So that, you said it, and it flew by my head completely. I felt the breeze as it was going by, and I didn't want to say anything because I didn't want you to feel old when you said it. But now now after your answer, I have to admit to you, I know what MASH is. I've never watched an episode, so that reference kind of flew by my head a little bit.
Off the air like 83. It's on like every night on every other cable channel. You have to have seen it.
Well, to be honest, I don't watch TV. The only TV I watch is sports. And if I want to watch a show, I use Netflix or I use Hulu. I don't sit down and watch TV. I can't remember the last time I watched something other than sports on cable TV. I can't remember. I just don't do it anymore.
Yeah, I remember those days quite well. Now, if it's on a laptop, I don't feel like I'm watching it either. So I get you on that.
MASH, not something that I'm super familiar with, but one thing that I am familiar with is I got this stat with some help from Josh Hyman of Respect the Note, and we discovered that on special teams, the Pittsburgh Penguins in wins are 24% on the power play, but in games that they lose, their power play is 7.7%. On the penalty kill, they are 88% in wins and around 70% in losses. So combined, they are a 34% better team on special teams in games that they win versus games that they lose. So this, to me, anyway, is for right now, a pretty striking statistic in terms of determining when the Penguins are going to win versus when they're going to lose. Because if they are successful on the penalty kill, they have a much better chance of winning, which, I mean, you could say for any team in any situation, but 34% is a pretty stark contrast. If they do well on special teams, they have a much better chance of winning a game versus when they lose. And right now, they've lost three in a row. They need to get a win to get themselves back on track here. But what to you has stood out from their special teams over the past few games?
Well, yeah, I think the statistic, as you mentioned, yeah, it's probably a little bit true for everybody, but it's very stark for the Penguins because they haven't had players to put the puck in the net. You know, beyond Sidney Crosby and Jake Gensel, there really isn't anybody on any given night you can point to and say, okay, we're going to count on that guy to score. So those power play goals have been very crucial. The power play has been quite fun to watch if you're into the X's and O's of hockey. Because of the movement, the cycling of players without the puck, you'll see Sidney Crosby, Andrew, in front of the net. You'll look up, and then he's over on the mid wall. He'll circle around the point. He'll kind of come in with speed down towards the net, and it's this little bit of a whirling movement they've got, things they couldn't do last year with Phil Kessel because he just wasn't going to be a part of that, right? Now that they've got guys buying in and they have to kind of make up for a little bit of that talent gap, they're doing these wrinkles and they're doing these interesting things on the power play, which, you know, when they get a little bit healthier, their power play is going to be absolutely spectacular, if not dominant, even more so than it has been, because the biggest difference is going to be if they don't score, they will still have generated some momentum. Whereas as before, if they didn't score, it was almost like a busted, wasted opportunity because they didn't generate momentum because they had guys standing flat-footed in the circle, not one-timing it, not moving. So that there wasn't that change in game flow. Now there is a whole flip to the flow of the game, which benefits the Penguins.
talk to me about that fourth line with Adam Johnson, Devils legend Joseph Blandisi, and Sam Lafferty, which two of the three guys, I'm going to be honest with you, I don't know a whole lot about. I know Joseph Blandisi as a Rangers fan watching him for the Devils for a few years. But other than that, Adam Johnson, don't really know a whole lot about him. And Sam Lafferty has been, like we mentioned, a surprise for this team with 5 points in his first 9 career NHL games. Tell me a little bit about that fourth line and what they bring to the table with some of the guys like Malkin and Rust and Bukes out of the lineup. You have to bring these guys up and you just have to inject them in the lineup and see what happens. And so far, at least for Sam Lafferty's sake, the fourth line has been exceeding expectations, I would say.
Yeah. However, I don't know that that fourth line will exist beyond the next couple hours. Even as we talk, I'm kind of looking at my phone a little bit, expecting that official announcement, because as soon as Brian Rust and Nick Bjugstad are activated, by NHL rules, two of those three have to go back to Wilkes-Barre Scranton in the AHL. So that's going to be Blandisi and Adam Johnson. You know a bit about Blandisi, kind of the blender guy, fast, a little bit tenacious, all over the ice. Adam Johnson is just he's a whistle. You know, he skates past and you hear the whistle behind him. He's really quick. He's still learning the NHL game. He's great on the forecheck. He can be overpowered. He can make some mistakes in the defensive zone. He's still coming along in that regard.
For Dominic Cahoon, a player that is on the second line, at least for right now, just 2 assists in 11 games, doesn't have a goal yet, and is playing with enough minutes and with line mates that would suggest that he should have at least a goal by now. With Bukestad coming back and Russ coming back, that should alleviate some of the pressure off of him to produce at a constant level. But through 11 games, he hasn't done that. Has that been a concern for the Penguins? Or is this kind of a situation where Cahoon isn't producing, but he's not... But Cahoon wasn't brought in to produce at a top six role, so him being thrust into that is a byproduct of injuries, and we shouldn't look at him not scoring a goal yet. Or is this more of a, while he's not a first line winger kind of situation, we do expect him to at least have a goal by now, and the fact that he doesn't yet is kind of alarming. Which of the two more likely demonstrates Cahoon's role on the Penguins team right now?
You know, I think it's a combination of both, and I'll throw C in as well. New team, new adjustment, all of those things. I don't know what to make of Dominic Cahoon. He didn't really start to come on until the last, I would say, 2 or 3 games for the Penguins. Otherwise, I wrote several times about him that he was invisible. He wasn't really contributing to the overall line he was on, nor has he contributed much offense. Now, that has begun to change over the last week or 10 days. Whether it's because he's getting comfortable, whether it's because, a coach kind of gave him a little kick in the butt. You just, who knows? But he's coming on a little bit. I don't think the Penguins know, Andrew, what they yet have in Dominic Cahoon. He was acquired as the Olimata salary dump. You can spin it whatever way you want. The reality was Olimata did not have a lot of trade suitors. So the Penguins took what they could get to move the salary. And that just so happened to be a guy who can score 40 points, or did score 40 points, 37, I think, for the Chicago Blackhawks. If he doesn't fit, if he doesn't work, they've already recouped the benefit of that trade. If he does begin to gel with, say, Malkin or Bukestad, more is the better, and the Penguins actually have some time and space yet to figure that out.
Talk to me about John Marino now, because this is another name that most hockey fans, even the most hardcore fans, don't really know a whole lot about. So with the injuries to Dumoulin and with Jack Johnson and Eric Branson still being on the team, you need players that aren't Jack Johnson and Eric Branson to hold down a top four role. He played in Harvard the last three seasons. He signed a two-year deal with the Penguins, and he's played all nine games so far for this team. What have you seen out of Marino's game and how he holds up in the NHL level so far?
Yeah, it really is interesting. We began to notice him in the Prospects Challenge in early September. Kid actually has a little something. And then he just kept progressing through training camp and in the preseason. I don't necessarily think he's top four defenseman for the Penguins right now, at least the way they're configured. He's been on the right side the last two games, with Chris Letang being flipped to his off wing on the left side. I think the drop in that pairing has been noticeable, because Letang has to flip it over to his forehand. He has to do some extra things to move the puck forward, or he has to kind of just bank it out off the wall, off the glass, on his backhand. That's not Chris Letang's game, so I haven't been entirely enamored with Marino in the top four, only because it displaces a very good defenseman, Chris Letang. To Marino specifically, though, he's a wonderfully swift skater. He is much faster than you realize. He is very agile, and he's got a great hockey IQ. When he's playing on the third pairing right side, like he did with Jack Johnson, he's able to pinch. He's able to take some chances. He's able to drift high in the defensive zone sometimes. But then he's fast enough to get back to where he needs to be. And he doesn't have any points yet in the NHL, but his level of play has really been a standout for a rookie coming out of college, sixth round pick, that the Edmonton Oilers couldn't sign. You know, he really has impressed a lot of us. He only had 11 points his junior year at Harvard, so I don't think any of us really expected to quite see an NHL player or an NHL-ready package that Marino has been.
Well, speaking of that defense, the biggest prospect that the Penguins have on defense anyway, at least the ones that aren't playing the NHL level right now, is Pierre-Olivier Joseph, who came over in that Galchenyuk deal. But after him, who by the way, is only 20 years old, still got plenty of time to develop down in the minors, right now anyway, is there a market for the Penguins right now to go and buy a defenseman? Because right now, like I mentioned, the Penguins have a lot of contract decisions to make this season before the deadline or before July 1st here. So with this blue line, you still got Jack Johnson, you still got good Branson, who, I mean, they're not very good. They're just not. With Dumoulin out right now, Marino playing his first games in the NHL, you got Letang playing on his offside. Will the Penguins look at acquiring a defenseman to at least plug and play for right now, or maybe even use as a rental for the rest of the season? Or are they willing to wait for Dumoulin? Are they willing to be not as good on the blue line for now anyway, while they wait for Dumoulin to get better? Or do they have a plan C that I'm not bringing up? What is the plan here for the blue line of the Pittsburgh Penguins?
Well, I'll argue with you a bit on the Jack Johnson, Eric DeBranson scouting reports. They're not very good. Each guy has a skill set. Actually, Eric DeBranson, when he came to Pittsburgh, was a bit of a revelation last season. He and Marcus Pettersson were puck-moving, skating demons all of a sudden. And everyone around the Penguins really excited about what Branson could bring to the lineup beyond just his ability to somebody through the glass or break his knuckles on their head. Branson had a lot more to offer. Unfortunately, with the way the blue line is constructed, Marino has kind of displaced him, and he's had to play the left side for a few games, and that's just not been his deal. He's not agile or quick enough on his off wing to flip it over and get the puck out. He and Jack Johnson especially, takes care of his own zone very well. And I don't think you see a lot of that on television, and I don't think fans are programmed to see that part of the game, the ugly underbelly, which Jack Johnson has come to specialize in at this point in his career. So when you start talking about options, will they acquire a defenseman? Probably not. That would be very difficult for them, unless somebody wanted to straight up acquire Jack Johnson or acquire Eric Gudbranson, which kind of puts Jim Rutherford in a total pickle, because their pieces and parts don't fit together very well right now, at least the way Mike Sullivan is using them. And I think that is really the next shoe to drop, is how they fix that situation. But they probably don't really get into it for at least 3 weeks, maybe a month, before we start getting back, you know, heavy into trade talks and trade rumors on that front.
Well, right now the Penguins have exactly $0 in cap space, and they have a bunch of RFAs like Jared McCann. Cahoon's going to be an RFA. Sam Lafferty's going to be an RFA. And I mentioned both the goalies, Matt Murray, Tristan Jarry, have expiring deals. They're going to be RFAs. Justin Schultz, a UFA. There's a lot of players right now that either have expiring contracts or are going to be looking for other teams, or are going to be RFAs, which leaves the Penguins in a bit of a cap crunch, because they have a lot of players that need new contracts, and yet they have exactly $0, according to Cap Friendly, right now anyway, to spend on those players. So you have to take a look at, okay, well, Jack Johnson's making 3.25 for the next four seasons, which, I mean, it's not a great deal, at least in my opinion. Eric Branson's making $4 million for the next two seasons. There's a lot of money tied up in Malkin and Crosby, which is fair considering they're the two best players on the team. But overall, the Penguins don't have a lot of cap space, and yet a lot of players need more cap space. So what is the solution for the Pittsburgh Penguins?
Well, they are going to trade Jack Johnson or Eric Gudbranson. I think Justin Schultz, who's going to be a UFA after this season, is probably playing himself into a bit of a longer-term contract with the Penguins, which was certainly a storyline that we had to follow. Yeah, they have to move one of those two defensemen. I think they know it. Actually, in talking with both Jack Johnson and Eric Gudbranson, they're both aware of the situation as well. I don't think either guy is buying any green bananas at the grocery store. It could happen any time. It might be after the season. Just don't know. But one of the two, perhaps even both, will be gone. Who else goes is quite interesting. I dropped a little bit of a nugget this morning on PittsburghHockeyNow.com that Brian Rust was, in fact, more heavily involved in the in trade talks than we realized until recently. So, yeah, somebody has to go. They signed Brandon Tanev to that very Rust-like deal a bit inexplicably. So it really is, it's a puzzle with too many pieces. How's that? And Jim Rutherford really has to start to figure that out.
Yeah, I mean, giving Brandon Tanev that contract was, I don't, not that it's weird, because giving that kind of a player a contract of $3.5 million over the next six seasons, I mean, it's a little bit much for a bottom six guy. The cap is going to increase, so it's not going to look as bad down the road. But giving a bottom six guy 6 years at $3.5 million just doesn't make a whole lot of sense. He's 27 years old, and yeah, I mean, he's looked pretty okay in the few games that he's played in a Penguin jersey so far. Can't blame him. I mean, he took the money and he ran with it. I'm not suggesting that, hey, you know, you got to blame the player here. You never blame the player for taking more money, especially in this situation. But that contract doesn't look great. Patrick Hornqvist, who I mentioned, has looked a lot better than he did last season. He's got 8 points in 11 games so far. But he's making $5.3 million for the next 4 years. He's only 32, so he's going to be 36 when that contract is over. Not to say that he's going to be super old, but he's not going to be super young either. And the worry, at least that I have for the Penguins, is that if he repeats the way that he played last season, then that contract is going to go from bad to worse. But if he does play well leading up to the deadline, what are the chances that a team takes on Hornqvist's contract at the deadline? Maybe not this season, because that's going to be a tough contract to move, but maybe 2 years down the road, if he's still serviceable, he's going to be on the move. Is there any likelihood that a team right now would take on his contract?
Oh, sure. If the Penguins wanted to move him, I think if you are closer to the Penguins, maybe we see it and others don't. Hornqvist is an animal. He obviously was a little bit slowed by an injury in the second half of last season. I think people forget last year that he had 15 goals in his first 35 games, but then only 3 goals in his final 30 games, or, you know, 30, 31 games. He is still, he's playing lights out. There's, of all the Penguins' worries and their contracts that may have been overpaid or overextended, Hornqvist is really not the one to worry about. Maybe in the final year of his deal, he kind of limps through it. That's always a concern, though, with the way he plays. But he makes the power play go because of the space he creates. He's versatile. He'll play with Malkin. He'll play with Bjugstad. The advanced stats, Andrew, with he and Nick Bjugstad are otherworldly. They routinely have a 60-65% Corsi in any game, own 60-65% of the scoring chances when those two are paired together. It really is, they have something going. The other guys you kind of asked about or alluded to, I think everybody else besides the Penguins' core then does become fair game. Hornqvist would be very tough to pry away, because what he brings to the locker room as well, but literally anybody else is on the block. Maybe next summer when the Penguins have to shed salary.
Well, they did shed some salary in the summer by trading away Phil Kessel. Now there is some sort of drama involved with that, and Kessel didn't want to divulge a lot of details into that, but apparently the situation behind the scenes wasn't great. Now, I'm not, if you know anything that would add to that story, but don't want to say, which I totally understand, but in terms of that Kessel trade, Kessel going to Arizona and Pittsburgh getting Galchenyuk and Olivier Joseph in that deal, what were your thoughts on that trade when it happened? And how does that trade look for both teams right now, 11 games into the season?
Well, yeah, I think everything I knew or know, I did print on Pittsburgh Hockey Now. I was actually, we were the first outlet to run with the story 12 months ago, or a bit more than 12 months ago. We earned just heaps and piles of scorn from Penguins fans who genuinely love Phil Kessel, like, you know, he's their bowling team member, and they came with guns a-blazing, you know, to defend him when we were merely reporting that this situation with Phil Kessel was beginning. There's just no question whatsoever that the situation had soured, that in team meetings, Kessel was less than coachable on numerous occasions, that on the ice, Phil Kessel did what Phil Kessel wanted to do, not what the Penguins were trying to do on any particular night. And there's just no question that he was a bit of an apple in the locker room, too, where he was perhaps more about himself than he was about the team after he got that second Stanley Cup ring. And so it just created a very untenable situation. All the sides can publicly say what they want. There is really the, I think, the core truth to the matter. Bill Kessel had worn out his welcome with the Penguins. The Penguins and Mike Sullivan had worn out their welcome with Bill Kessel. I don't know if he's going to become that leadership material. It all remains to be seen if that really works out. All sides were ready to move on. What the Penguins got with Alex Galchenyuk, or as you mentioned earlier, Pierre Olivier Joseph, no one quite knows yet, because Galchenyuk may be an insect bite, maybe something else. And so, Andrew, we'll see where it all goes. To be determined, but the Penguins, I do really think, will be better off regardless of if Galchenyuk works out.
Fair enough. And a couple of players that didn't get involved in any trade right now are the goaltenders with Matt Murray and Tristan Jarry. Matt Murray hasn't been overly incredible. I called him aggressively average in the few games that he's played so far this season. He's 5-3. According to HockeyReference.com, his goals saved above average is 0.02. So that is literally two hundredths of a point higher than league average. So he is pushing it in terms of being about as average as he could possibly be in through eight games that he's played. Jarry, though, been playing a lot better than Murray in his three starts. He's only won one of those, but pulling a .939 save percentage, and he's saved three goals above average, according to HockeyReference.com. So he's, at least on paper, played better than Murray. How has the goaltending looked so far, and what are the Penguins looking for out of Matt Murray? Because at he's pulling a .909 save percentage, which isn't too bad, but for the Penguins to do as well as people hope they would, I think the expectation for Matt Murray is he's got to be at least a little bit better than what he's shown through eight games so far.
Yeah, I think the small sample size might be working against Matt Murray right now, because he's been really good in most of the games. The Penguins did in the first two of their first three games were absolute stinkers, especially opening night. They let Buffalo hang, I think, a four spot on Murray. And it really should have been a 7 or 8 spot on Murray. But he really held them in. And so sometimes those goalie stats can be a little bit misleading. I think, generally speaking, he's been very good. Jarry has been, in his three starts, outstanding. The Penguins didn't necessarily expect to keep him out of training camp. That's where that whole trade saga really began. And the Penguins management did tell at least one player in the locker room that a trade was forthcoming. And Casey DeSmith was sent to Wilkes-Barre, but not expected to stay long. So when, in fact, that trade, whatever it was, didn't occur, the Penguins were kind of stuck with Tristan Jarry, because he's $350,000 less expensive than DeSmith, and the Penguins are so tight, that matters. Jarry has seized his opportunity with both hands. He was absolutely brilliant on Wednesday night against Tampa Bay. The Penguins were outmatched, and Jarry, for the first 30 or 40 minutes, kept the Penguins in the game and gave them a real chance to win it. In fact, they had a third period lead. How much longer Jarry plays at that level, I don't think any goaltender really can, unless, the second coming of Patrick Waugh. But Jari's emergence certainly is giving a lot of scouts something to watch and something to look at, because we know that Jim Rutherford was offering Jarry this summer and didn't really find a taker to his liking. Well, any scouts have seen the first three games Jarry has played. His stock should be really going through the roof right now.
Well, like we mentioned, the Penguins are pretty injured so far, but how good is this team as it is? And like you mentioned, Rust and Bukestad will probably be back for tomorrow's game against Dallas, but they're still shorthanded, and Malkin's gone, Dumoulin's gone right now, Galchenyuk's still on IR. How good is this team currently, and how good can they be if, it's a big if, because being healthy for any team is always an if. But if the Penguins could get healthy and everybody's in the lineup, how good are they if everybody is playing on a given night?
You know, that's a really good question that I don't have an answer to. I predicted the Penguins would be fine, that they would make the playoffs without much difficulty, but they were probably going to be second-round fodder this year, maybe even first-round fodder. So much of that answer depends on what becomes of Malkin and Galchenyuk this season, what becomes of Hornqvist and Bjugstad, and what becomes of that trio, the third-pairing defenseman, John Marino, Jack Johnson, Eric Gudbranson. I think the Penguins have extraordinary depth and an emerging team unity and an emerging team identity, which is going to serve them well. I think their speed and their physicality is going to serve them very well. Now we have to find out how much contribution they're going to get or how much additional contributions they're going to need at the trade deadline.
I don't want to say Mike Sullivan's job is under microscope or anything, because he's done so well for this team, back-to-back cups. I mean, this is a great coach for the Pittsburgh Penguins. But is there a scenario in which you can envision that, if not fired at least this season, he could at least be on the hot seat? Is there any situation, barring a complete and utter collapse, because if the Penguins go, 6-76, then I would like to believe that Mike Sullivan's not going to have a job for much longer. But barring them losing the next 71 games here, is there a situation or is there a scenario in which Mike Sullivan's job could be on the line? Or even if they don't make the playoffs, is Mike Sullivan's job pretty secure?
Yeah, it really is largely secure. Barring something catastrophic, Mike Sullivan will be the coach of the Pittsburgh Penguins next season. I don't know if you see the trend and the pattern. Columbus has done the same thing with John Tortorella in terms of going through the ups and the downs and the changes and really beginning to build an organization in the mold of their guy, John Tortorella. You know, they've adopted that personality in Columbus. Mike Sullivan is very similar, and I see the Penguins taking that similar path. The players who will fit with Mike Sullivan, serious, intense guys who are bit blood and guts kind of players, those are Mike Sullivan players, and those are what the Penguins have been gravitating towards and away from that traditional high-flying Penguins type player or type winger. Right. So I think their lot is cast with Mike Sullivan. Again, barring something catastrophic, something unforeseen, even if they stumble this year, they will keep building for Mike Sullivan rather than finding somebody else to come and coach the team.
Well, a couple of coaches right now that are in the news is Rangers coach David Quinn and Leafs coach Mike Babcock. Now, David Quinn still, for some reason, and I wish there was an answer, I feel like we're not going to get it unless David Quinn comes on the show, which would be phenomenal, but I don't know if he has time for that right now. David Quinn, sort of inexplicably, continues to play defenseman Brendan Smith on the third forward line, and I will never understand. I don't get it. I don't get the obsession with doing that. Especially, he did it a little bit last season when Kevin Shattenkirk was on the Rangers still. And if you want to put a defenseman on the forward line, you might as well put Shattenkirk on there instead of Brendan Smith, because Shattenkirk is better offensively. He didn't do that. Shattenkirk got bought out. Now, this season, if you want to continue to put a defenseman as your 12th forward, not as your 9th forward, which apparently is what Brendan Smith is on the Rangers right now, but if you want to play defenseman as a forward, Tony DeAngelo's got 3 goals in his last 2 games and is much better offensively than Brendan Smith. If you want to force a defenseman to play forward, I don't understand continuing to do that with Brendan Smith, a player that does not have any offensive capabilities. And whenever he has the puck, he either gives it up pretty quickly or doesn't know what to do with it. He's very conservative with the puck. He doesn't know what to do with it if he has it. And the offense pretty much dies whenever he's on the ice as a forward. So that, to me, doesn't make any sense. And now this kind of all adds up to Vitali Kravtsov, the Rangers prospect, is now going back to Russia for this season. He played in Hartford and now is going back to the KHL for the rest of the year. He could come back in March when the season's over over in Russia. And it's not the end of the world because, again, he just got drafted last season. There's still a ton of time for him. And there's no room to panic. But one thing that I read on Twitter today was a tweet from at Hockey Robinson, Cam Robinson, about the Kravtsov situation. He said, "Panic will likely set in here, but remember, the KHL is a perfectly fine league, arguably better than the AHL. He'll be comfortable and should develop for the year. However, the Rangers opting to use Brendan Smith as a forward instead of Kravtsov or Hedel, who remains in Hartford, remains damning." Now, 110% agree with that. I don't understand why David Quinn continues to force Brendan Smith, not even as a 12 forward. If you want to play him as a 12 forward when there's an injury, whatever, I don't like it, but fine. Putting him on the third line is, I'm going to call it a disaster because it is. Because he can't play offense and stifling the rest of your team's offense, playing a defenseman in that role, when he's not capable, when he's not suited to play that role, is just not good coaching. I'm just going to call it what it is. It's not good coaching.
Was there a question in there?
Well, what do you think? What do you think of that situation? Like this whole Brendan Smith playing on the third line. Now Kravtsov is going back to the KHL for the year. I mean, this to me doesn't feel like good coaching. But I might be a biased Rangers fan in this example, in this situation. But. From somebody that, yeah. I mean, I've watched hockey for so many years that to me, this doesn't feel like a good coaching decision. Do you agree with that? Or is there an angle here that I'm just not seeing?
Well, I haven't seen the Rangers in person yet. So I always like to, put my eyes on from press box because television can sometimes be a little bit misleading. But I am never in favor of putting a defenseman at a forward spot, except in emergency situations, or unless they're really good at it. There have been a few of those kind of tweener guys every now and then around the league. No, it's David. Speaking of John Tortorella, Mike Sullivan, David Quinn is also one of those BU guys, like Mike Sullivan, very much in the same mold and as a coach. And the one thing I have learned both working in the same organization a long time ago as John Tortorella and now covering Mike Sullivan for a few years, and guys like David Quinn. The one thing I have learned is there isn't always a logical reason, but there's always a reason. Sometimes it's to kick somebody in the butt. Sometimes it's to send a message. Sometimes it's organizational reasons, but there's always a reason for that. So I don't know what Quinn's reason is for eschewing talented young players. I do know that the Rangers have had difficulty over the past couple seasons in not being very tough to play against. And when you start talking about Russian players, those guys are notoriously skill guys, not necessarily gritty guys. And if he feels like Brendan Smith is going to bring him a little more grit on that third line and not hurt him, or if they have some advanced metrics, that really could be the reason. I'm guessing. I'm pulling at straws here, but that's the best answer I can give you.
But the offense dies. It truly dies when Brendan Smith is on the ice. And nothing against him as a person. I haven't talked to him. I don't have him over for Thanksgiving, so I don't know him, on a personal level, but playing him as a forward when he's just not suited for that role, to me, no analytic will suggest that Brendan Smith is good offensively. There's none that would show that because he hasn't done anything that would positively affect the offense. And to put a defenseman again, putting him as a 12 forward in certain situations, I'm not a fan of it, but whatever. Putting him on the third line instead of a forward in that position, to me, makes zero sense. Quinn probably has a reason, but to me, whatever that reason is, doesn't justify not putting a forward in your top nine instead of Brendan Smith. He's not good at it offensively, and to put him as a forward in that position, there's probably an answer, but I don't think it justifies the reasoning anyway, because of his ability to just be not good in that particular role. Even in sheltered fourth line minutes, he wasn't doing well offensively. And if you want to say, oh, well, he's a gritty guy, he's a, you know, hashtag grit, if he adds sandpaper or insert, you know, that hockey word here, at the end of the day, a forward needs to be able to score goals or at least contribute offensively on the ice. Brendan Smith, as a forward, does not do that. So by definition here, and also for sandpaper and hashtag grit, well, you got Brendan Lemieux, who was out there rattling Jeff Skinner last night, because there's a clip of him saying, I own you, to Jeff Skinner on the ice last night. So that's, I feel like that's enough hashtag grit for the team. Like, this, you don't need a third line, you don't need a defenseman playing on your third line that can't score goals, that can't contribute much offensively, to be your hashtag grit player. To me, that doesn't make any sense. I mean, maybe there's a different answer to that, but for right now, I don't see it. I truly just don't. All right, Dan, would you have 30 more seconds to answer one more question?
Yeah, 30 seconds. I can do a quickie.
All right. I have a segment called The Biggest Stretch. I'm going to name you four bullet points here, and I want you to tell me which of the four to you is the biggest stretch. You ready?
Okay.
Number one, the Penguins will be one of the top three teams in the Eastern Conference this season. Number two, the Oilers can continue the successful bold strategy of only having a single scoring line and will have home ice advantage in the first round of the playoffs. Number three, Tampa Bay remains inconsistent and makes the playoffs, but as a wild card team, far below season expectations. And number four, JT Miller has 10 points in 9 games right now. His career high is 56 with the Rangers that he set back in the 16-17 season. He will continue to be red hot all year and set a new high with at least 65 points. Of those four, which to you is the biggest stretch?
Biggest stretch would be JT Miller doing a point per game. The Penguins could be a top three team in the East. Tampa Bay very well could sputter like they did 3 years ago, do that all season. And, hey, who knows how good McDavid and Draisaitl can really be. So we'll go with JT.
Fair enough. I would have to pick the Penguins as being one of the best teams in the East. There's so much competition, and the Penguins are so beat up right now that their inconsistencies will not lead them to a top three spot. But that remains to be seen. Dan, I really appreciate taking the time. If you have another second, plug your social media, plug anything you want. The floor is yours, man.
Oh, well, hey, check out PittsburghHockeyNow.com. Really do appreciate everyone checking out. We do report on a lot of the comings and goings of the league in addition to just the Pittsburgh Penguins. And over the course of 20 years, I think we've developed a few sources as well that I know fans love to get into the trade talk, and we don't shy away from it there either.
Dan, I really appreciate you taking the time. I'll talk to you again real soon.
All right, man. Have fun.
And this has been episode number 71 of Chelsea Squared, number 72 coming out next week. I'll talk to you then.